This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, so it's time for our Week in Review. And the question on the table this week, are we sick? In the Commonwealth, 40 communities enter into the high-risk category, even as we continue to reopen. Here's Governor Baker.
This is a contagion. It is massively contagious, and it will wreak havoc on many people if they become infected.
Among those red communities, Boston, which is now delaying its next phase of in-school education.
I want to be absolutely clear. We will continue to ensure that our schools are prepared to protect the health and safety of our students, our teachers, and all of the people and any of the people that are in them.
Now, in Washington, the president's back at the White House after a hospital stay for the coronavirus. Last night, he called into Fox News.
But I will say this, absentee is okay, because absentee ballots, absentee ballots are fine.
And the election's weeks away, the pandemic is raging, and here at home, race again takes center stage after ICE agents stop a black man while jogging.
Do you have any, do you have any tattoos on your left and right arm so we can confirm?
Do I have to show you? If I'm free to go, then I'm not showing you anything.
Alongside breaking news today that the head of the Somerville Police Union has been put on leave for charges of assault and battery. It raises the question, are we in some way sick as a people in Massachusetts, in America? Call us. Join the conversation and tell us what you think at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our two panelists are with us, of course, remotely this week. First, we have Marie St. Fleur. She's a former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications and the CEO of a cannabis company. Marie, welcome back to Recon Review.
It's great to be with you, Tiziana.
Also with us, Ed Lyons. He is a Massachusetts Republican activist and a political writer. Ed, welcome back to you as well.
It's good to be back in a place where no one interrupts you.
There you go. Well, only a little bit at least. All right, so let's dive right in on the questions around COVID here in the Commonwealth. The trend lines have been going up for a couple weeks now. That seemed to really break through our collective psyche in the Commonwealth this week. Marie, are you concerned?
I'm always concerned. I mean, I've had friends who've had COVID. I've had family members pass away from COVID. So I'm very concerned. But it's not unanticipated. I think all the data suggested way back when, 3 months ago, that we would see a resurgence around this time in the fall, and we're experiencing it. And so, I said that it's upon all of us citizens, wherever you are, to take the necessary precautions. I mean, it's really not simply a government thing. It's an everybody thing. And all of us need to do our part to make certain that we keep ourselves and our neighbors safe.
So, Ed, let's pick up on what Marie just said. It's upon all of us to take the necessary precautions. We've got active cases jumping 20% in the last week. The number of red communities has doubled. Is this a trend that we can stop without drastic measures? Is it that we're just loosening up on the necessary precautions that Marie just referenced? Is that enough if we tighten our belts on those behaviors again?
I think it's all up to us. So, you know, the Boston Public School System made the news because they're worried about the testing percentage. But at the same time, the Boston Archdiocese, the Catholic schools in Greater Boston, including many schools in Boston, have 32,000 kids, 4,000 teachers. They've had 12 cases, and none of them came from school. So somehow they're operating a school system, and people aren't getting infected. So I do think it's about being conscientious, what you can control. I think we can do a lot ourselves in order to protect ourselves.
Marie, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about, the state, the Commonwealth has a dashboard. There are five metrics that we follow, things like hospitalizations, rate of new infections, percent positivity. We seem like we have a different set of thresholds for schools, a different set of thresholds for businesses. We will always, until we have a vaccine that's really penetrated the populace, have this trade-off between full safety, public health, and being together, full economic activity, et cetera. At this stage, 7 months in, what's the goal? Is the goal to avoid any infections? Is the goal to mitigate it? What should the goal be?
I don't know if there's one specific goal, because the scientists don't know much. As much as we'd like to think that our scientists and medical staff have all the answers. They don't. Everybody's learning about this disease as it evolves. And so what they've been able to learn as it evolves is what things could mitigate it. And those goes back to, you know, the social distancing, the sanitizing of your hands, and wearing the mask, some basic things that we're being asked to do. I think, we should observe those. And hopefully, as the scientists are working on a vaccine, and hopefully we will have one that is released based upon what the scientists say is safe, and not what the politicians say is safe. And so those are the things that we're waiting for. And until then, we as a community have to continue to be that commonwealth. I think and have the discipline and be willing to sacrifice for each other, which are terms that we're walking away from. By the way, there are people who've been sacrificing, right? Some of us have been able to work from home from day one. You know, we're the lucky ones. We're able to stay in our homes or wherever we choose to isolate and work. But others have been out sacrificing for us, whether or not we've been at 8.1% or 1.7% in terms of rate of infection. And those are the healthcare professionals. Those are emergency staff. Those are the folks who clean. Those are the folks who are at our grocery stores. They've been doing it. So sacrifice has been happening across the board, some of us taking more of the direct load than others.
So, you know, I want to pick up now on the schools theme, which Ed mentioned a minute ago. It has felt so many times during this pandemic like the schools are the stage on which so much of the tragedy and tension and confusion of this pandemic winds up playing out. So we know that Boston shut down the next phase of in-person learning after a trigger of 4% positivity, actually 4.1%. Mm-hmm. Ed, you compared that to Catholic schools which are operating. So does that mean you think the city's making the wrong call?
No, I mean, the city has a different composition of students in it. They have, it's not the same system. I just meant that's a shining example of people who are in person and they're figuring out a way to do it. And it's great. It should be an inspiration. I don't think it should necessarily dictate what Mayor Walsh and Superintendent Casilius are doing. But it should inspire us to say, boy, if people do the right thing, if they really try, we can balance it. I think a lot of this is about balance because public health is more than the virus. There are people with tremendous health problems that aren't getting them solved. There are people who are very desperate because of lack of employment or because they're sick. I just think it's a balancing act between, you know, all different kinds of public health to be as healthy as possible overall and not just view it as the virus alone.
And let's grab our first call on this. And listeners, what do you think of the surge in coronavirus in the Commonwealth? How are you feeling about it? What about the economic impact of it? And what about the choice to slow down the reopening of in-person learning in the Boston Public Schools? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Mira on the line from Jamaica Plain. Mira, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I want to say I'm recently a former Boston Public School parent. My daughter just graduated from the schools, and I'm also a Boston Public School teacher and a member of the teacher union. And I'm in an incredibly privileged spot compared to most people in Boston because I've been able to keep my paycheck and work remotely for the most part since the beginning of the pandemic. And that said, I also want to say that I'm disturbed by how WBUR and also your news intro at the beginning of Radio Boston are covering what's happening right now with Mayor Walsh and the schools, because it seems like there's very little emphasis on the fact that he's illegally violating a binding agreement that he signed with the teachers union that said that when positive testing rate got above 4% citywide, we would go back to all remote. And that has happened, and yet he's still requiring teachers to go into the school buildings. You know, I have close friends and coworkers and neighbors, all of whom have small kids, and I understand the problem. But if we had decisive leadership in the city of Boston like they have in some other cities, we could have decided back in July that we were going to be remote. Teachers are working their butts off. I'm working 12 hours a day.
Let me take it back from you there, Mira, and I respect and appreciate the 12 hours a day. I think it's important to understand how hard teachers are having to work to teach in an entirely new way under entirely new circumstances. So full respect to you, Mira, for that. I do want to raise her point about this tension around the memorandum of understanding between the Boston Teachers Union and the city. The dispute there, as I understand it, is this 4% threshold. And as the memorandum of understanding is written, It does allow teachers to return to remote learning and for the schools to return to remote learning unless the Boston Public Health Commission deems it is safe. And it sounds like what is at dispute is the Boston Teachers Union believes the emphasis is on at 4% we return to remote learning, and the city is arguing the Boston Public Health Commission deems that it is safe. Marie, that is such a rock and a hard place for everybody. What's the right path forward for the teachers in the schools?
It is a rock and a hard place. And I guess you can interpret, you can focus on that direct line. I mean, having been a former lawyer, you can actually take both sentences and interpret it just as you have, and folks emphasize what they want. But at the bottom line is, in Boston, there are many families who actually have to go out and work every day, and who've been doing it every day without the benefit of protection and without the benefit of being able to stay home. And so the question is not whether or not, I think Ed said it, it's really the balancing act in terms of our own responsibilities and the need that we have to provide support and educate our children. I mean, because some families need some students need that in class support. They really do. And they actually, their lives are being totally disrupted and interrupted if they don't get that education. They don't get to get that degree to be able to help themselves out. So the question, I think, is these adults need to sit around the table, put the kids at the center, and figure out how you make it work for children. Because whether it's at 4.1 or 8.1 or 12.1, kids still have to be educated. And some parents still have to go out and face the music. And work. And so I think we can all fight around language, and I am very sympathetic to the fact that it is frightening out there. But let's not just get caught up in the language and think about what we need to do for kids to educate them.
Yeah, and I do want to note the WBUR's. Yeah. And I do want to note that WBUR's education team has been doing actually an extensive amount of reporting on the agreement between the unions and the mayor. You can find some of that on our website at WBUR.org. I want to pick up another call here on the coronavirus, 800-423-8255. We've got Lisa on the line from Northborough. Lisa, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I know we have an uptick in the cases because, you know, the students are all being tested, and especially in the colleges. Like, I have two kids being tested twice a week in the colleges that they're at. But so we're, of course, going to see an uptick in the cases. But from what I understand, the death rates are way down because the virus has moved through the vulnerable population. And I'm just wondering if that's being discussed at all, if that's being taken into account with all of these measures that we're doing.
Thanks for that question, Lisa. And it's a question I have heard a number of different times. How do we even track that successfully? And are we paying attention to it? Ed, I don't know if you particularly know the level, at which the Commonwealth is tracking that. So you may or may not be able to answer Lisa's question directly. But either way, are you feeling confident that the metrics we are using are the correct ones?
I'm not an expert in this. I mean, I trust our leaders that the meaning of the numbers changes over time. We know more about the virus than before. Getting sick with it doesn't mean quite the same thing as our doctors and hospitals have learned how to treat better. I think that we have really protected our most vulnerable citizens. I think it's changed, and I'm confident that Governor Baker and Mayor Walsh and other experts have updated their thinking on what the numbers mean, and I hope they can continue to express what they think the numbers mean now. It's not just numbers alone. We didn't elect a spreadsheet to be mayor, to be governor. We elected people who are capable of absorbing expertise and interpreting them for us. So I have faith in the people. I don't understand the numbers in detail.
Maria, I want to ask one more question. We have to go to a break in a minute, but I'm going to ask it anyway, even though it might take us over a little bit on this segment. I'm noticing the difference between the reaction in Michigan, where we've had several men arrested on state and or federal charges for plots to kidnap the Michigan governor, for try her for treason and or incite a civil war. Now, there's a lot going on in there, but that is not where we are in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Ed was just talking about leadership. Is it because of the relationship between our leaders in our cities and the state and the people? Why are we in such a different place on this?
I think it's our orientation about what we think about democracy. I think there's a set of people in this country who have decided they want to throw the book out and what democracy means, and that they have their own, dictator-like interpretation. It's my way or the highway. I think that we still, in Massachusetts, we're not perfect. We still have some real challenges, as you can tell in the news from day to day. But the reality is the aspirations that are set in our Constitution, both the Massachusetts and the Constitution, the United States federal Constitution, we still believe in. And hopefully our leaders, and I think that in many instances, our leaders are really trying to live up to those ideals and helping and joining in with community to live up to those ideals. I think that when I look at Michigan, you know, a few months ago, I think it was in April, a group of white men in militia garb with guns, you know, just invaded the statehouse there, and they were let go. I can't imagine a group of black men invading the Michigan State House and not be thrown down on the ground and then arrested and probably being tried right now. But not, all these guys got away. And now what do we have? We have them coming back to attack a woman, right? For some reason, a woman who's standing her ground because she believes that she has to defend the health and safety of the people of Michigan. And they've been given the okay to do this. So I think we are in a better place in Massachusetts. But like I have to say, we have to be vigilant about it. And citizens have to remain vigilant. And I think as long as we remain vigilant, then we will continue to attract good people to this business called politics. And we can continue to hold them accountable.
All right. And just a quick note, Michigan is one of just a couple of states in the union that does a law allow firearms in their state capitol at the State House. Ed Lyons, Marie St. Fleur, listeners, stay with us. There is more ahead. We'll take more calls when we come back. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This is Radio Boston's Week in Review. Welcome back to Radio Boston's Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and still with us is former State Representative Marie St. Fleur and Republican writer and activist Ed Lyons. We have been taking and will be taking the local and national temperature this hour on the pandemic, race, politics. Is the Commonwealth or is the nation ill? And listeners, for this next little bit, we are going to talk about the president's illness with the coronavirus this week in the vice presidential debate. So if you have thoughts you want to share, call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. All right, Ed and Marie, I want to start with this kind of strange unfolding of the president's illness or recovery, depending on who you talk to this week. There are several videos that came out this week that kind of seem out of touch with the mainstream experience of the disease. I want to play a little sound from one of them to give you some feel. This is the president talking about how quickly he recovered from the coronavirus.
I'm a senior. I know you don't know that. Nobody knows that. Maybe you don't have to tell them, but I'm a senior. We are making tremendous progress with this horrible disease that was sent over by China. China will pay a big price for what they did to the world and to us. But we have medicines right now, and I call them a cure. I went into the hospital a week ago. I was very sick, and I took this medicine, and it was incredible.
I do want to be clear, because we are a journalistic organization, that we have no reason to believe that the medicines that the president took that we know about this week are cures for the coronavirus. That being said, Ed, I do want to ask you, how are you feeling about the president's recovery? Are you feeling confident about it?
No, he's been lying to me about his health condition since he started running. He's never told us the truth about his health, so I have no more information than I had 3 years ago. So it's very hard for me to be worried about something I know nothing about. I just I pray for the country, and I don't know what's happening to him.
Yeah. Marie, anything you want to add there?
Pretty much. You know, he's a very privileged man, so he can say, he has been able to say what he wants to say or not say about his health with impunity. I am, you know, he's been able to, unlike many other Americans who fell ill, they did not have direct access to testing right away. Many have had to wait until they were actually showing symptoms in order to be able to get the test. In his privileged situation, he's able to get testing right away, and he's able to get free testing. He's able to get a free ride on the people's dime to a hospital, one of some of the best medical care in the country. And that, of course, that was paid by the people as well. Many of the people who are sick today in hospitals today will have to figure out how they're going to pay for their medical bills.
And you know what? I'm going to backtrack. It's not sitting comfortably with me. I also want to note that we don't have evidence that China sent the coronavirus to the United States. And I know some people find that line of rhetoric from the president to be quite offensive. So I want to underscore that as well. Ed, it does raise a set of questions briefly about what information, quality information, the American public is entitled to about the health of their president. I mean, my personal health is not governed by the 25th Amendment, but the president's is. And we know there's a long history of people not getting truthful information from White Houses about the health of presidents. But how important is that? And is there any way to make sure we're getting quality information?
I mean, I think there's a line that in terms of what is fully shared, because the individual also has rights, that some of it, which is has to be managed differently because of the responsibilities he has. Right.
Yep. And Ed, let me have you weigh in on that, too. Sorry, we had a little confusion on our sound there. If I sound a little distracted there, I apologize. Ed, let me have you weigh in on that, too.
Oh, sure. I do think that the press is going to do its best to try to keep us informed about the activities of the president and the people around him. I do think we have a right in general to know the health of the president, since we're very invested in the presidency, you know, as an office. And I just hope the media can do their best to let us know what is happening. I don't think this president is going to tell us what he owes us about his health. That's been the case for years. I don't think it's going to change over the next 28 days.
I do want to note, and then I want to move on to the vice presidential debate, but we do now know that the president is saying that he's preparing to take a medical exam on Tucker Carlson's Fox News show tonight from a doctor who has touted hydroxychloroquine and has made false statements about the virus as a commentator on Fox News. So I imagine that we're going to have more to say about that in the days to come. I do want to get to the vice president debate, because this is a situation, often the VP debate, not a huge deal, but we've got one candidate that has a potentially deadly virus. The other candidate is the oldest candidate in history. Whoever wins is going to be the oldest sitting president. I wonder, did we learn what we needed to learn about important issues such as the transfer of power should a president become ill? Ed, were you satisfied that we got answers we needed from the VP debate on Wednesday night?
Not on those specific things, but I do think we learned more about these two people. And I do think for Senator Harris that it was an opportunity for her to be seen by much more of the country as the vice presidential candidate. I thought that part was good, because we didn't, the Democrats had paid attention to her during the Democratic primary, but I don't think the whole country had a reason to tune into her until the debate. So I think it's great they were able to see her. I think they already understand who Mike Pence is.
So, Maria, I want to play a little exchange here for you on the question of the vaccine for the coronavirus. First, here's Senator Harris, who was making clear that she doesn't trust a vaccine that only the president vouches for.
If the public health professionals, if Dr. Fauci, if the doctors tell us that we should take it, I'll be the first in line to take it. Absolutely. But if Donald Trump tells us that we should take it, I'm not taking it.
Now, Vice President Pence then went on to say that she's undermining public confidence by saying that. Is that an undermining of public confidence, or is it appropriate for her to call into question the president's messaging on something as important as a vaccine?
It's absolutely appropriate for her to call in the question, particularly by the gentleman who is who she's talking about. He has consistently lied for over 3 years. He has consistently lied to the American public. We know that we are not his priority. If you listen to the Woodward tapes, we know that the American people are not his priority. So why would you believe anything that he says? And so I think that Senator Harris was absolutely correct. If the science supports the necessity for us to take the vaccine, absolutely. But if it is simply a political calculation by the sitting president, then I would not advise anyone to take it.
All right, I want to play one more piece of sound here, because after the break, we're going to talk about race and policing here in the Commonwealth. And I want to play a little bit from Vice President Pence, who refutes the assertion that systemic racism exists in America and calls it offensive to law enforcement.
That you hear consistently from Joe Biden and Kamala Harris that America is systemically racist. Mm. And that, as Joe Biden said, that he believes that law enforcement has an implicit bias against minorities is a great insult to the men and women who serve in law enforcement.
Now, Ed, you can hear Senator Harris actually give sort of a groan of frustration at that message. It was essential that Vice President Pence somehow addressed the president's failure to call out white supremacy in the previous debate. Was this an appropriate message from the vice president?
I don't think so, not in this moment. I mean, a lot of my fellow Republicans have a hard time with the term systemic racism. But there's no question there are patterns of discrimination in institutions. And I think we're capable as a society of saying, you know, we support the police in general. There are a lot of good cops, but we keep seeing all this data showing that, you know, there are unequal outcomes and unequal treatment all over the criminal justice system. There really is hard data for all of this. And systemic racism is a term Republicans don't like, but it reflects a very real thing. So I don't mind if Republicans don't like the term, but they need to see the actual pattern. And Vice President Pence said the pattern wasn't there. And I think that's offensive.
Thanks for that. And we're going to pick back up on that theme here in the Commonwealth when we come back from a break. Marie St. Fleur, Ed Lyons, listeners, hang on. Listeners, if you want to call about the ICE questioning of a runner this week or systemic racism in policing, you can call after the break at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston's Week in Review. Welcome back to Radio Boston's Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Deering, and still with us is Republican writer and activist Ed Lyons and former State Representative Marie St. Fleur, and you. And in this last stretch, we are going to talk about the questioning by ICE agents of a black runner in West Roxbury, some news today about the head of the Somerville Police Union, and police reform and where it stands in Boston. If you have thoughts on those things, call us. Join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So I want to ask the two of you, I want to start and ask you if you're alarmed or surprised about the stop of black jogger Ben Apriela by ICE agents on Tuesday. ICE says they were pursuing an ongoing investigation into someone of a similar description who was slated for deportation and had been criminally involved. I want to play a little bit here of Apriela, who spoke with WBUR, and here is how he described the encounter.
These guys just hopped out in full camouflage uniforms with masks over their face and stopped me and told me to immediately identify themselves. I was confused as whether or not they were even legitimate authority.
Now, Marie, ICE didn't confirm their identity in this until Wednesday, and no statement from them until Wednesday night. How are you reacting to all of this?
Tired, honestly. Just really physically and emotionally tired. You can't be a black man or a black person just living as an American. You have to be targeted. You have to, you profiled. I mean, this man was simply jogging, right? In West Roxbury, in all places. Why would they have pulled over if they were looking for a Russian guy? Would they have pulled over the first white guy that they saw jogging in West Roxbury? No, they wouldn't. And that's the problem with systemic racism. It's really about reproducing a culture. And sometimes you say it's not the individual, but the individual is exercising what the system has taught it, right? It is implementing what the system has taught it. And the tragedy about us is that we don't want to talk about it, and we push away from it. And until we put it all on the table and deal with it, we're going to have to continue to have that. I'm going to continue to have conversations with my son about how to be careful, where his friends who are white don't have to have those conversations about being careful when a police officer approached them. That man should have been able to go on his jog and to be able to go home and not feel that he was being profiled by people who came in fatigues and did not even want to say who they are because they felt privileged to do that. And so that is what systemic racism does. It allows you to use your power to stop an individual because you can. Because you can simply because of what he looks like. Simply because of what he looks like.
I want to pick up a call to your point, Marie, here. We've got Amy on the line, 1-800-423-8255. We've got Amy on the line from my screen's cut off, but I think it says South Brockton. South Brookline, excuse me. Amy, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I live in the immediate neighborhood where this incident took place. In fact, my house is literally around the corner from where this man was stopped. And my son is African American. He could just as easily fit a very vague racial profile And it terrifies me as a parent that he could have well been stopped just like this man was. My son walks that same stretch of the VFW Parkway every day to play basketball at the park that's right there, Hines Park. And I'm terrified that this would happen and that I have to teach my son right now that he needs to learn that he has to ask for a warrant if somebody should ever do that to him. And that seems crazy to me.
Amy, we're losing your sound there. I'm so sorry for your fear, and I'm sorry for your worry. Ed Lyons, I'm going to turn to you here. There's been a lot of reaction to both the legality and the appropriateness. It's an insufficient word, but the appropriateness of ICE pursuing this investigation and doing what many are accusing of racial profiling of this young jogger, this young man in West Roxbury. What is the appropriate role between federal law enforcement like ICE and our local communities? In ICE's own statement, they actually referred to themselves as ICE slash police. But the BPD is something very different.
I think this was wrong at a much earlier stage than pulling this man over. I mean, why are they not labeled? Why are they wearing fatigues and camouflage? Are they in the jungle? I don't. The whole setup is wrong. Why are they here without our police being aware of their presence? There's just so much that's wrong with this. I mean, perhaps they were looking for somebody who looked just like this person, but everything else was wrong before the stop even happened. So yes, I mean, it seems like it's a racial profiling case, but I have much bigger concerns about federal agents. This is what we saw in America a few months ago. You have federal agents lined up with weapons and in camouflage, and no one knows who they are. This is not America. That we can't have that. We have to have people working with, like Governor Baker said this, like, you know, when the state police come in, they talk to the locals before they go into a community. There's a lot of collaboration. Everything's up front. That prevents all kinds of abuses of power. So everything about this is wrong. And I hope that once, hopefully, if Joe Biden is elected, the fact that we can have a conversation with the federal government about how you want ICE to operate when they're in our Commonwealth.
All right. I want to grab one more call on this. We've got Maisha on the line from West Roxbury. Maisha, go ahead.
Yes, I also live in an area right around the corner from where this incident happened, and I'm a runner. So the first thought that I had was, were these really ICE agents? Were these vigilantes who felt emboldened by the current situation in terms of our administration? And even if they were ICE, am I now at risk for being stopped myself? And for the first few days after this incident, I was afraid to run in the neighborhood and decided I couldn't. And I think that that's a horrible way to live, and I just would hope that we can have a broad enough conversation to make sure that everyone feels comfortable where they live to be able to walk or run down the street without worrying about the color of their skin. And as a Black woman, I should never have to feel that I can't run in my own neighborhood.
Maisha, thank you for that call. I do want to reiterate, ICE did confirm in a statement on Wednesday that they were, in fact, ICE agents. Marie, we're going to kind of wrap up here on this conversation. Also, just briefly for listeners, Ed, I think you were referring to the unmarked vans that were being used to pick up protesters in Portland. I'm going to assume that's a yes. Marie,
yes.
Let me give you the last word in response to Maisha before we move on.
And I thank Maisha for calling in. I think there are many of us who are just fatigued with all of this, because there's one part of the ledger, people deny that it exists. We're living in two different worlds in America. You've got the world that I live in, understanding that these possibilities exist for me and my families, and you have others who refuse to recognize that it happens. So we really need to go back and unpeel the onion as it relates to race in the United States, race in Massachusetts, and really begin to look at our institutions and how racism impacts our systems, because they are executed and we allow people to then implement what is that system requires in the daily lives of folks who walk around, unbeknownst to them that they're going to be stopped. You know, that's going to stay with that gentleman for a very long time. So structural racism, institutional racism is real, and it plays out by the forces by the institutions, by the individuals that we allow and give power over the citizens of this Commonwealth. And whether they're here from the federal perspective or whether they're here from state power. We need to have real conversations about bias and really make certain that we begin to eradicate them. And we won't eradicate if we will not have the conversation, if we will not look at our policies, if we will not look at our programs, and if we will not look at training to make certain that we shift the way things happen on the ground.
Okay, we have about 3 minutes left, and we at Radio Boston are dedicated to making sure we bring a little bit of joy, even during those difficult weeks, or something a little bit unique or different. So briefly, I want to do our hubbubs, which are those local events or stories that caught our eye this week. Ed, did you have one for us?
Well, I had a serious one, but we'll go put on Twitter, is that I walked into the grocery store the other day, and I saw a whole full aisle of candy. I was really surprised that there was no acknowledgement that the pandemic is here. And I thought, oh, my goodness, I guess we're going to be safe, but I guess we can have our candy and eat it, too. So I'm pretty impressed that Big Candy has decided we're all going to have a normal Halloween. So that made me laugh.
Well, that was fantastic. In fact, I'm glad that you brought it up because I'm not sure we'll have time for three. And it was actually my hubbub was your tweet, because Ed's tweet said Big Candy doesn't want to hear the quote, things are going to be a little different this year, end quote, line now does it. And I just thought that was a great little bit of humor. Marie, I don't think yours is humorous, but I think it's an interesting angle. So why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, I know I'm going to try something else. Actually, I could not find anything joyful yesterday. Was that when I was looking for hubbub? But today, today's the 9th Oslo. The Nobel Peace Prize is going to the World Food Program. And I think that is a wonderful thing in this world today. When we think about the number of people who are lining up for food every weekend right now, you know, I was talking to a pastor earlier who was giving out food, making certain that people will have food through the weekend, where we are in America today, but that there is an institution or that really does that around the world to make certain that hunger is not used as a weapon of war in conflict. So congratulations to the World Food Program.
And as Marie just noted, we have a number of really substantial food pantries and food pantry networks in the Commonwealth. It's an area of strength in the nonprofit sector here. And so great to see all of that work being recognized. All right. Well, what an interesting week. I do hope that there will be some day where it'll be easy to find joy again. But even when it's not, I find it really rewarding to get to talk to folks like the two of you to break this down. I look forward to it all week. So Marie St. Fleur, a former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications, CEO of a cannabis company, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Ed, I want to thank you, too.
You're welcome.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We love it that you listen. I'm Tiziana Deering. Why don't you join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston?